Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? Alright, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Slate's XX GabFest is sponsored by Ring, the video doorbell that allows you to see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Get $10 off when you go to ring.com/XX. That's ring.com/DOUBLEX. And by The Great Courses, offering the new service, Great Courses Plus, with over 4,600 video lectures on history, science, photography, and more. Watch as many as you want, anywhere, anytime. And try it for free if you're one of the first 100 people to sign up. Right now, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com and use the invitation code XX. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com and the invitation code XX. And by Next Issue, the mobile app that lets you tap directly into the world's most popular magazines, anywhere using your phone or tablet. Dive deeper into Vogue, People, Esquire, Time, and more with interactive content for a richer reading experience. Right now, try Next Issue out for free at nextissue.com/XX. That's nextissue.com/XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, August 20th, the call-in show. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and the Atlantic. I'm recording today from the beautiful Cliff House Audio Studios in Montpelier, Vermont, where I'm on vacation. And I'm joined in New York by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June. Damn it, I haven't done that in a while.
I know.
I was getting in trouble. I piss off the listeners when I do that.
I know, and really it's just that you're in vacation mode.
No, it's like I'm anti-something.
You are. You're a terrible homophobe.
Yeah, I'm a big homophobe.
Hey, how you doing?
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hey, Noreen.
Hi.
I got that right.
Yep.
I said that correctly.
Pretty easy.
Before we start our live show, we really want to see you there. Our D.C. friends and friends from near D.C., come in and hang out with us September 21st at Woolly Mammoth. It's going to be an awesome show. So come. You can buy tickets at slate.com/live. You will see our show. It's like the third or fourth listed there. And of course, for Slate Plus members, you get a discount as always. So please do come and we will announce our guests shortly. Let's get going. Today is our call-in show. Listeners, you guys left us lots of great messages and questions, and we chose a few and we are going to answer them right now. All right, let's get going.
My name is Laura Jane Kenny, and I'm calling in from New York City, which you might be able to hear in the background. My question that I'm curious what you all think about is this duality I've noticed between men and women in terms of being encouraged to work in something that kind of procures social good. But I work in marketing, in fashion marketing, and it feels, even though it's a pretty female-heavy field, that my career is maybe assumed to be a little less full of heart or good. And I feel frustration towards this, one, because I probably am dealing with it somewhere in my psyche of wanting to, you know, join the Peace Corps and give up everything, because some part of me has been raised to believe that that's more important. But the frustration I find is I don't think that men deal with these same pressures. It's something that I find frustrating in my millennial age. It seems counterproductive.
So, we did some research. It turns out it's so much worse than you think. Not only are women encouraged to go into nonprofits, they don't make it into nonprofit leadership, nor go into nonprofits that are very, you know, successful, like the big nonprofits. So it's more depressing than you think.
In general, it's really hard to say this, because I know that jobs are something where, you know, the idea that, well, you shouldn't do that. I guess I'm blathering because I know that it's insulting to tell people what they should and shouldn't do with jobs, because essentially that's the nature of the question. But like, people shouldn't, like, just need to let go of pressure about jobs. Like, work can be so miserable already that going into something that you know you're not going to be excited about is just so fucking miserable. Like, by all means, do something that you love that doesn't pay very well, or do something that you hate that pays great. But the idea of, you know, doing something because you feel pressure that is still then not going to be particularly buckalicious just feels so, I don't know, so terrible, miserable.
Well, I think Laura doesn't have to choose between doing good and doing the job she wants.
Right.
And I think she can sort of take a playbook from men. So if you look at Silicon Valley, it's actually... many of the startups are super superficial. You know, it's people trying to get your lunch delivered quickly. It's people trying to, you know, make laundry easier for you. And these guys, and they are mostly guys, are saying, we're changing the world. So I think what Laura can do, if this is something that bothers her, is figure out a way that she can argue that fashion marketing is changing the world, that she's, you know, empowering women to be able to wear clothes that they love. Like, you can, it's all in how you think about your job.
Oh, my God, I love that. It's all about the narrative. That's so true. You know, one more thing to Laura. You reminded me of this really, the most irritating study that I quoted in my book was a study out of New York University, Different Reactions to Men and Women's Altruistic Citizenship Behavior. And it involved this test they did where they had men and women walk by their Xerox machine on the way to an office party. And at the Xerox machine, this was all staged, at the Xerox machine was a guy who was freaking out because he had like 400 papers to staple. And then the question was, you know, the guy was like, please help me staple these before you go to the party. And they tested people's reactions about when people said yes or no. So the men could say whatever they want. Like, if they said no and went to the office party, it was fine. Nobody judged them for it. If they said yes, that was fine, too. They didn't particularly get extra points. But the women were docked, like, mercilessly if they said no. You know, and they didn't particularly get any extra points if they said yes. It was like, well, yeah, that you're supposed to do that. Like, as a woman, you're supposed to be altruistic. Anyway, all I'm saying is, Laura Jean, I think that the prejudice is deep, and that, you know, the pressures are deep, and you should resist. I like Noreen's solution. Just create a narrative to shut people up by which whatever it is that you're doing is actually perfectly altruistic. All right. Let's talk to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I'm the mother of an 8-year-old boy and a 4-year-old girl. Let me start by saying that I detest princess culture, avoid pink, and encourage both my children to play with all toys, even those stereotypically deemed for the other gender. In other words, I try to keep things gender neutral and try very hard not to influence them too much. I want them to simply make their own choices. My daughter likes to play with her dollies, but she's also into Lego, superheroes, and pirates. She's a regular kid, but she doesn't like princesses at all. When we are out, she is constantly being greeted by adults with, "Hello, princess." My question is, how do I politely respond to this without offending anyone or going off on a feminist tangent? Sometimes I say that she's more of a pirate than a princess, but that usually confuses people, and it doesn't address the actual issue of addressing a whole generation of girls as royal highnesses. Any suggestions?
All right, who wants to go first on this
one? All right, I can talk. Well, there is a sign that maybe the culture is moving away from princess culture. Just in the past couple of weeks, Target announced that they're no longer going to label things as girls' toys or boys' toys, which I think is great because kids don't, I mean, they do think of it that way, but not totally. Kids just play with what they want to play with. It's actually the adults who, like you're saying, are reinforcing it. But what I would say as a complete non-parent with no parenting experience, I almost feel like making a point of dressing down someone for calling her a princess draws more attention to it and she'll get fixated on it, and just sort of letting it breeze on by. And if you're not reinforcing it at home, I think what she'll pay attention to is what you're saying to her.
I think sometimes overreaction can make kind of draw attention to it in a way that a kid might not notice. I think if you just kind of focus on doing some major eye rolls to the person who's doing this very stereotyped sort of greeting, that'll probably do the trick.
You know, this reminded me of that situation that Senator Kirsten Gillibrand faced where, you know, she had ran some guy at the gym, was like, I like my girls chunky or whatever it was that this jerk senator said to her. And it's like you're dealing, like you kind of know that the world has passed this by, but that a lot of people still hold this in their heads. And so do you want to really make a point of it? I actually thought that Anna's solution was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like something where you just make a joke, you're kind of letting the moment pass, but not quite letting it pass. I ran this by different generations in my household because I'm on vacation. So I ran it by the grandparents, the parents, and the kids. And they all kind of agreed that it would be weird to make a giant feminist point of it, largely because of what you said, Noreen. Then the kid would become really interested in it, mm-hmm. especially a toddler. They would be like, oh, there's some power here. There's something I can play with here and use, and, you know, something my mom's really interested in here. So more for the kid's sake. But if you just did a little slightly funny dig like that, then it would be, that's the best solution.
You know, this reminds me of something, a question that I've actually been asked several times, which is parents of young kids have said, you know, you go out with your super cute kid and their kids are always super cute, and people will come up and say it's a little boy, and they say, oh my God, you are so handsome, or you're so cute, you're going to break some girl's heart. And, you know, my friends have said, like, it feels like it's a heterosexual assumption, and that, you know, should I say, or boy, or would that be weird?
Also that he's going to be a jerk breaking hearts, you know?
Exactly. And I've always said, again, with zero experience with children, that I think that would bring more attention to it and just kind of make it a thing. And I think it's more important, since you're the one who spends so much more time with your kids, just to be more open and, you know, not, and just to kind of indicate that the world has many options. So it seems kind of a parallel with this situation. What do you guys think about that?
That sounds good to me. Again, no,
what do you mean?
No.
Wait,
kids.
What is June saying? You should say what?
That you shouldn't say, you know, you shouldn't respond to the person saying girls, or, you know, the assumption that your son will be straight. You shouldn't like make a big thing of it in the street. You should just, in your time with them, which is much more plentiful than this rando on the street,
right,
you should just offer many opportunities and many options, and, you know, show that there isn't more than one choice or more than one way to live.
You know, it's funny, as you guys are talking, I kind of sank into the moment, like into Anna's moment. Mm-hmm. And like everything you're saying is absolutely true. But in the moment, there's like something infuriating about a stranger assuming a destiny for your child, a child who, especially if it's your first child and you know the child so well, and this person is slotting your child into some cliche destiny that you are desperate for the world to change or be better for your child. I'm just like feeling Anna's pain for a moment and thinking, like, it's irritating. It's like damn irritating, even though in your head you know that your activism should happen elsewhere. Like, it's much more useful, whoever it is that like banged on Target's door and said, like, damn it, stop separating the boys and girls toys, or stop selling girls clothing that, you know, looks like streetwalker clothes for little toddlers or whatever. Like, just stop doing that. You know, that's a better place to take your activism. It is in these momentary interactions with strangers. They somehow, like, you want to strangle the person. So that's not helpful. Don't strangle the person, Anna. But anyway, I was just feeling your pain. All right, let's move on to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Ashley Gerst. I'm calling from Memphis, Tennessee, and my question for you today is related to marriage and couples who choose to ignore the traditional standard of bride takes groom's last name. I'm a member of the millennial generation, and myself and many of my friends are choosing to keep our own last name. I have considered combining my last name with my husband's in particular for our potential future children. As a Southerner, I'm constantly asked, what about the children? So my question is, how do you think combining and creating new family names will affect future generations?
Hannah Rosenplatz, I think this one is for you.
Yeah, Hannah Rosenplatz made a mistake by saddling her children with the terrible name Rosenplatz. And actually, we've only come to realize it now, a decade later, as my child is, oldest one is a teenager. And you're just like, what the hell? Like, why would you do that? Like, this is like, we've now moved from Anna to 10 years post-Anna with our next caller. And it's like, you just kind of did this sweet romantic moment where you think, like, we're a big happy family and we're just going to mush all the names together. So that's one problem. But this is a genuine feminist problem that I have never heard a good solution to. And in thinking about it, we should probably call on our intern, Jessie Chasen-Tabor, in case she marries a person with a hyphenated name and ends up with one of these ridiculous hyphenated names with four names that people have. And you couldn't possibly live life with a four-name name, right?
Well, like, that's just silly. Except that you can, like, Spanish people, and I believe everybody on the, you know, the Spanish-speaking Latin America, they have four names, essentially, because a child has two names from their dad and two names from their mom. So if your dad was, you know, Pedro Abascal Banderas and your mom was Maripaz Cruz Duarte, you would be Fulanito Abascal Cruz, but your full name would be Fulanito Abascal Banderas Cruz Duarte. So like,
was good.
And you never
came.
June lived in Spain for a while. Deep cuts of June's
skills.
Life.
But you never change your name. Like, also, Fulanito is a really funny joke, but only six Spaniards will get it. You never change your name. And even before feminism came to Spain, like, Spanish women would never consider changing their names. And it's our weird thing is being obsessed with having the same name as our kids, at least till our female children get married. And I just don't get that. Like, why does it matter that you have the same name as your kids?
Yeah, so my mom didn't change her name. Oh. But you know, we're all Malones, not Brennans. Mm-hmm. And I don't get why people don't just do that. I get that the Brennan falls away, and then it seems like the Malone is taking more precedence, but then the whole family feels like a family. I don't know.
No, but your mom is left out of the family. See, I think that's the worst solution, the one that most people adopt.
She's not, though.
Right, but like, take it like, okay, I'm just gonna, like, practically speaking, you're a parent at the school. Generally, I know the mothers, and like, I just, like, you don't know what the kid's last name is, and like, you can't necessarily find the kid. There is this weird, like, disconnect, but then I'm starting to think it doesn't matter. You know, like, in families in America, like, who gets married anymore, and who knows whether it's the father's name or the mother's name that people are carrying? And in Europe, like, nobody gets married, so I don't even know what they do. Like, if you're one of those Danes where you don't get married but you have three children, whose name do the children have? Like, what do they do in the Scandinavian countries? It seems like more and more historically it just doesn't matter.
You know what I wish? I wish we were like Iceland and we just, like, our names had nothing to do with our either patrilineal or matrilineal heritage. It was just, if we were a woman, our mother's first name, daughter, you know, so I would be June Edith Daughter. And what would you be, Hannah?
Wait, how would it work?
So mother's, if you're a woman, you take your mother's first name and add daughter. So I would.
Daughter?
Daughter. It means daughter.
So mother's name is Miriam.
So you'd be Hannah Miriam Daughter. And what would you be?
Noreen Marielle and Dottier.
See, that's awesome. And then if you have a boy child, it's, you know, Noah Davidson, or, you know.
Yeah.
Even as I say that, and I've always liked the Icelandic way, it is a little.
Who among us hasn't?
Right? Yeah. It is a little gendered. And given that we're, you know, in a period of much more gender fluidity, I mean, so I guess, you know, Petra Hannah's daughter could become Petra or Peter, you know, Davidson at some point. But I still like that notion of, like, it doesn't matter what your last name is. It's such a holdover from, you know, concerns about illegitimacy.
That's true. But it does need some gender reform. Like, Noreen, the problem with the solution your mother does, which a lot of people do, is, like, why do the children always get the father's last name? Like, why is that the assumption? So most of my friends do that.
Yeah,
you know?
I think it's traditional and probably offensive on some level, but let's not overthink everything. But mm-hmm. I actually have been shocked to find that a lot of women my age change their names. Mm-hmm. I think actually there is kind of a rolling back. Like women, my mom's generation, it was a thing where they didn't do it. And now all these girls I know are, you know, I don't recognize anyone's names. They pop up in my email and I'm like, oh, right, you got married. Or on Facebook, oh, right, you got married. It's shocking to me the number of people who've changed their names. And I am puzzled.
Yeah, it really freaks me out when lesbians do it. And sometimes, like, I've asked...
Oh, is that a thing?
Yeah, well, I've asked younger women and sometimes they say, well, it's because we want to have children and we want to have the same name. So, you know, it's a kind of a traditional reason, but it still freaks me out.
Whose name do they choose?
Generally, the people I know have combined their names, but there are some times where the more masculine presenting name is the one that's taken.
Huh. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's so retro.
Our next caller is going to ask about whether lesbians are objectifying women on the street. But before we get to it, our first sponsor is a fabulous new app, Ring. So when you hear the doorbell ring, it could be a package being delivered or friends coming over for dinner, but it could also be someone coming to rob you. Over 95% of break-ins happen during the day when we are at work, and most burglars start by ringing the doorbell to see if someone's home. So with the Ring video doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Its motion detector alerts you. Even if someone doesn't ring the doorbell, it's like caller ID for your home. Installing Ring takes minutes. It works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. So put your mind at ease, protect your home with the video doorbell Time magazine says is one of the top gadgets of 2014. Right now, listeners get $10 off the Ring video doorbell when you go to ring.com/XX. You're always home with Ring. Go to ring.com/XX for $10 off. Okay, let's go to our next caller.
Hey guys, my name is Emily. I am a high school senior, and I'm a huge fan of the podcast. And my question is for the lovely June. So as a queer woman, I sometimes feel that my attraction is objectifying other women. So I was wondering, is there anything inherently objectifying about, you know, seeing another woman on the street and thinking, oh, she has great legs or a nice butt or, you know, whatever. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, there's nothing wrong with thinking that somebody has a nice butt or great legs, but never make any assumptions about their whatever. That is off limits. Okay, so first of all, like, if it's in your head, that's okay. You can think whatever you want in your head. But, I think when it gets problematic is when you say things out loud. And I generally think that, you know, as women, we're just so much less likely to express appreciation in a way that is offensive or objectifying or, most important, will make somebody feel uncomfortable. I guess it also matters, like, why you are making this observation. Is it, you know, as some kind of flirting? Is it just really, like, you know, you're kind of walking down the street and thinking, "Ay, mami," you know, is that kind of, you know, catcalling? That's probably off limits. I mean, and I totally get that it is a question. And I, when I'm writing sometimes and I want to say that someone's lovely or whatever, like, I always do second guess of thinking, like, am I being, you know, kind of creepy or objectifying or, you know, kind of dirty old woman kind of thing. So I totally get the concern, but I tend to think that as long as you're being respectful and you're being kind of doing it in the spirit of not making anyone feel awkward or uncomfortable, that it's actually kind of fine. What do the rest of you think?
Yeah, I mean, don't, you know, like June said, don't express it out loud. But everyone in the world on some level wants to be objectified a little bit by the,
right,
certainly by the person they're romantically involved with.
Right.
So don't, you know, don't think that you can only like someone for pure intellectual or personality based reasons. If you do that, it's like almost a little offensive.
Right.
So the Sheila Hedy and Heidi Julevitz book, Women in Clothes, has a lot of testimonies from women and about how good they feel when other women essentially objectify them. Now, I guess it's not the same because it's not necessary. It's not like it doesn't have a sexual component. It's just cool admiration. Like, it made my day when I put together this outfit and it was clear to me from the eyes of the woman passing down the street that she admired the outfit. Now, maybe that's different. That's not the same as sexually objectifying someone, right?
I mean, I guess.
I think it's
June,
different.
I just want to point out that this is like your third accent. on this podcast, you've now done three accents.
I know.
It's really impressive. So is there catcall? Like, have you ever seen one lesbian catcall another?
I haven't, although that might just be my sheltered upbringing. It's interesting that we actually had an Ask a Homo question about this that was asked about gay men. And J. Brian Lauder, my colleague at Outward, answered it and said that it's a matter of it being in the spirit of things, that in certain neighborhoods, especially gayborhoods, where there's an expectation that, you know, that any kind of attention from other guys is done in this spirit of admiration and sort of positivity, that as long as it's done in that spirit, that it's fine. But obviously, if you're in a more contested neighborhood, then it, you know, it just kind of changes the vibe. So it's all about the vibe and all about clearly being welcome, I think. But I don't think there's much for women.
Wait, but June, what about like a lesbian bar? What's the, like, is there sort of a sizing up, you know, of, or do people not hit on each other in an I'm objectifying you kind of way, or no?
No, totally. I mean, in a sort of, if you say pickup, that sounds sort of, I don't know, negative somehow. But yeah, certainly there's flirting and, you know, all the other things that one gets in a bar when people are there to, you know, find a potential partner. But
pick someone up,
I guess, would be okay to say. But I don't know, objectifying, I think you're right. Like, it's all about how we define it. Is it something that's negative, which I guess it's a negative word, generally speaking. It's something where you know you've gone too far somehow. But, you know, appreciating people seems perfectly fine.
Yeah, I mean, this question was specifically like a lady walks down the street and you think she has great legs. You know, yeah. How much can you show in your eyes?
Right, right. I mean, I think it's totally fine to think whatever you want to think. And that's very, I think that's very positive. You shouldn't, you know, censor yourself in your head. But yeah, just don't yell anything at them unless you know them and you feel like it would be okay.
Like Jimmy Carter, you can sin in your heart only. Was that the line?
Exactly. Sin in your heart, not on the street. All right, next caller.
So I manage a number of young staff and interns, and so I hear a lot of upspeak and vocal fry, and I never remark on it, but I do wonder whether in certain professional contexts, like when they're in a job interview or when they're presenting to some older people, that I should counsel them to be aware of those vocal tics, because society is normalizing that those speech patterns, but we're not there yet. And it's quite possible, in fact, likely, that if they're talking to older people in a professional setting, they may be suffering a bias when the older folks hear upspeak and vocal fry. So do you think I should keep my mouth shut about that entirely? Or should I say, in this particular circumstance, maybe you should become more aware of your speech patterns?
I would say, yes, you should keep your mouth shut. Your question implies that it's something that people can turn off and on, that it's an affectation that is truly an affectation. And I think certainly for me, and also for other younger, or not even younger at this point, just sort of people, the way you talk is somewhat uncontrollable. You can work on it, you can try, but to imply that they, you know, can walk into a meeting and suddenly, you know, talk like Katharine Hepburn while the rest of the time they're Britney Spears is not realistic.
That was very restrained.
Yeah. And it sounds like the question comes from, a good place, but all it seems to me that it would do would be to make those women feel self-conscious and potentially awkward and, you know, give them, just put something on their shoulders that shouldn't be there. It's an added burden. And I think it would, you know, I know in the short term this doesn't seem so, but just it feels like it would be so much more productive to get people to let go of these ridiculous ideas that they have in their heads about voices. And we've talked about this ad nauseum, but like, we just got to stop with this, people.
I also think vocal fry in some ways is a reaction to upspeak. Like a lot of people my age, I was counseled over and over again, don't talk like a valley girl. And what's the opposite of talking like a valley girl? You talk like this, you know? And I think it isn't necessarily that you're going to be able to fix it that easily.
You know, if you really want the answer to this question, you should listen to our friend Jess Gross, who was on Terry Gross, no relation, different spelling, talking about this exact subject. And Jess's story was really interesting because what she said was, you know, she worked at women's magazines. She worked at Jezebel, then she worked for XX, and then she started writing business stories. And when she started calling people, and she would call these business guys, you know, she'd be reporting her stories, and they would say things like, oh, you sound like my granddaughter, or how old are you? And she then started to get worried. Like, until then, her voice had not affected her job. So she went to voice training and tried to fix her voice, basically. And what happened was what you say, Noreen. She went from Valley Girl Upspeak to Vocal Fry, and she got incredibly self-conscious. And then, like, time passed, and she just stopped because it was making her crazy. So she forgot about it. And as she says now, she doesn't know if her voice ended up in a different register or what. But she actually did get worried when she found, when somebody did say out loud what this caller is saying he wants to say and think, oh my God, but it's affecting my career. You don't want, as a reporter, someone to think that you're 12 years old or, you know, like a little frilly girl. Now, is that, you know, her fault or the business guy's fault? Like, either way, she just didn't want it to happen anymore.
Of course not. And everyone wants to sound like as much of a pulled together human being as they can. And I want to sound a lot more pulled together. I want to eliminate a lot of things from my speech. I do think it is something that happens with time. I think as I've gotten older, the way I speak has changed. But it should be something, most people are aware of how they talk. And it should be something that you're working on to change yourself if you want to, not something that, you know, a manager at work pulls you aside to say that, like, oh, most of the time it's okay that you talk like a little girl, but when you're in the grown-up room, try not to do it.
Right. What if he gave, okay, one last thing. What if he gave, like, a big talk to the intern class? I don't know if he has this authority of this position, you know, general, like, men, boys, men, women, like, just everybody gets a talk at the beginning of the year, you know, about presentation. You know, they do give talks like, don't wear your shorty shorts to work. So just add it in, like, here you are in the big grown-up workplace now, interns. These are the 10 rules you should follow if you want to be successful in terms of the superficial appearance.
That, I think that's a really good point, Hannah. I think it's a very tricky message to communicate. But if you do choose to, you know, try to tackle it, do say something to everyone. I think, you know, I'm not a manager at this point, but one of the best things I learned as a manager was when there's something that's just a little bit sensitive, it's better to say it to everyone. And, you know, sometimes that's from a, you know, a liability point of view, like you should just make sure that you're not targeting people. But it's also just good sense. If you, you know, to get a message, it's better if you're giving that message to everyone. So, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
All right, next caller.
Hi, this is Erin Warhol from Minnesota. My questions are all about the New York Magazine article, the cover story that Noreen wrote. And I'm just wondering what led to kind of the thinking around the dignity in the women and just your impressions about that. And then secondly, I wanted to ask about the empty chair and how that became kind of a phenomenon that took on a life of its own. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about what you maybe were surprised about that and what you saw and what you learned from it.
So I think the dignity that the project afforded the women was almost baked into the concept. So the concept from the beginning was actually a visual one, that we were going to collect as many of these women as we could get to, first of all, come forward with their names and tell their stories and be willing to be photographed. If you're doing that, if you're asking people to do all that, you're of course going to treat them with dignity. So it wasn't exactly, you know, a conscious choice. I can't imagine a world in which we'd have smeared them.
No, but it was so interesting, like how deliberate it all was, you know? Like, I was wondering, it seemed so carefully planned and thought out and so just visually perfect and powerful. I was wondering how it all got, I mean, we haven't talked since that came out, but I was wondering how, if it just kind of, like, once you saw the final product, you could see all the power of it, or if it was in the planning.
I think it was in the planning, and this was something our photo director conceived of, actually, so it really did start in that department. but I dropped by one of the photo shoots and you could just see the way that the photographer was treating them. I mean, they, you know, they had a couple outfit changes. They were black and white clothes to be very neutral, but they could bring their own. Just everything was really thought through. They did a number of different situations. And then, you know, everything in a magazine is, if you're doing it right, carefully chosen. The photos were agonized over, and I'm glad that the effect was one of dignity. That's the best possible outcome, and it makes me really happy to hear that.
Can you explain what the caller is talking about the empty chair?
Sure. So on the cover, it was all the women who had agreed to be photographed and interviewed about their experiences with Bill Cosby, and they were all sitting in chairs, wearing black, kind of staring at the camera, tiny figures in a row, taking up the whole cover. And then the last chair was empty on the bottom right corner of the cover. And we'd intended it as somewhat open to interpretation, but there were women who, for a variety of reasons, had come forward to accuse Bill Cosby, but did not want to participate in our photo shoot. There are also women we knew from our interviews who said that they had had similar experiences to what these other women were alleging, but they had not come forward at all for also probably a variety of reasons. So that was sort of how we were thinking about the empty chair, was that like, okay, who's going to come sit in it next? And then the piece sort of took off on social media with a life of its own. Women who, you know, obviously thought that what these women had done was brave, but they knew that they, or for whatever reason, they could not talk about their own, or they knew people who could not talk about their own sexual assaults, and really like took the hashtag and repurposed it as a way of talking about reasons why, you know, the culture might not be accepting of people who came forward about rape.
I love that empty chair. It was both an accusation and an invitation. It was both like a mark of everything that had gone wrong in sexual assault and reporting and the silencing, but it was also how to kind of come sit in this chair. Like, it's a big sisterhood here. And so if you want to, you can come. Like, things have changed now. This is the end of the long process. It was really great.
And the women who were photographed for our story have really sort of taken hold of the empty chair as a symbol. They want to get t-shirts made. They're so into it, which I loved.
All right. Our next call is about being childless by choice and resenting the privileges that people with children get. But before that, we are going to thank our next sponsor, Great Courses. We are big fans of the Great Courses. We've talked about them many times on the show. We've learned about many things we're interested in, psychology, photography, at our own pace, and because we want to. And that's why we're excited about something new from Great Courses, a Great Courses Plus video learning service. Unlimited access to thousands of fascinating subjects. This is a whole new thing, so you're not going through one course, but you can choose from many. The Great Courses Plus is over 4,600 video lectures, history, science, photography, cooking, and more. As always, taught by award-winning professors and experts from National Geographic, Smithsonian, the Culinary Institute of America. You can watch as many as you want, anywhere, at any time. Here's the really cool thing. They're officially launching this fall, but our listeners have an opportunity to be one of the select few to try it now with a free beta access, but only if you use the invitation code XX spelled out, D-O-U-B-L-E-X. And apparently it only works for the first 100 people, so use it quickly. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com and enter the invitation code XX spelled out. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com. Invitation code D-O-U-B-L-E-X. All right, let's go to our next caller.
I am childless by choice, and I do have to pick up a lot of slack for women who are on maternity leave or otherwise out with pregnancy and babies. And when it comes to raises and salary negotiations, those kinds of things, we're supposed to look over, I guess, the fact that they were out, but looking over the fact that they were out is also looking over the fact that I did two times the work for however long they were out. And, you know, I'm a good feminist. I toe the line, but I have a really hard time with that. And I don't know if I necessarily have a question. I would just like to hear your thoughts on it.
I want to keep playing that part where she says babies, you know, like babies has so much spite in it. All right, I'll let the single, the childless go first.
I think that's a real emotion, you know, in our culture. Like, if you say I have to leave to take care of my kids, you're looked on as a terrible person if you judge someone for that, right? That's an excuse for getting out of work, right? Not getting out of work like you're
not an excuse, a reason.
Yeah, that's a reason that people respect. So the people who don't have that reason, you know, they end up having to stay late. You know, someone's out on maternity leave, you cover for them. And it can be, you know, not the greatest feeling in the world to be like, well, doesn't my personal life matter? You know, if I need to leave for drinks with someone, doesn't that matter?
How am I ever going to get children if I don't go and have that drink?
But I think it's one of those things. You have to look at the bigger picture and say, I'm part of society, I'm part of this company, I'm just going to play my role in the social contract. What I will say is, just as a work negotiation tactic, it sounds like maybe there's something, you know, at work you feel like you're being passed over, or someone's being promoted who you feel like you picked up the slack for them. Instead of seeing that person as your enemy, make them your friend. I mean, this is someone who owes you. This is someone, no one knows better than this woman what kind of work you've been doing for the past 6 or 9 or however many months. And if you need someone to go to bat for you, if you need someone to, you know, be your ally in meetings, I think this is your person.
Yeah, I think it is really important not to get resentful about the extra work that you're called upon to do. Like, don't take it out on the person who's on maternity leave or paternity leave. You know, if you're not getting the due that you deserve for the extra work you're doing, that's something to take up with your boss, your manager, whoever. And also, it's really easy to sort of focus on people who are out on maternity, paternity leave. But people go out on vacation. You know, we all have to cover for all kinds of, you know, absences. And if your place of work is severely understaffed and it's making your life miserable, don't just suck that up. I think, you know, I'm somebody who does this myself, but, you know, make it known. You know, we sometimes think that our managers know exactly what we're doing. And if we don't tell them, they don't necessarily know. One thing I will say, though, is that I do wish, I mean, I know, too, that maternity leave is not a vacation, that there is so much work and so much adjustment and so little sleep. I get all that totally. But I do wish, as somebody who is also childless, that there was some possibility of, like, okay, you get to have a sabbatical. You know, not to insult people who, and all the work they have to do in a maternity leave, but if there was some kind of, some break that you could take, you know, for professional or for your work development, you know, whatever might be appropriate for the kind of work that you're in. But I do wish that there was some kind of, you know, it's not a reward for not having kids, but just so you too get to have a little bit of break from the workplace.
I love that idea. Wait, Hannah, do you see the childless among us as peons to do your bidding while you pick people up from soccer practice?
Hell yes. Bow down. No, I feel the cruelty of this so hard. Like, this to me is so bizarre, this like weird American or something idea or American workplace idea that it's like this singular woman has to go home and take care of her singular child. Like, all of you workers were children once and somebody had to bring you up. And it could be your dad or it could be your mom. Like, if this were all normalized, so it wasn't seen as this like selfish act. This is just what all mammals do. Like, children have to be raised. Like, you got to be around sometimes to raise them. Their father does, or the mother, or the grand. Somebody's got to do it. So if it wasn't like we are all just work beings, and I'm with June 100%. I think it's totally weird that, you know, most workplaces have 2 weeks of vacation and that you don't get to take sabbaticals from your work. It's like we are all human beings, and like children are born in this world, and somebody's got to take care of them, and, you know, people have to have vacations. It's like this weird way of seeing things that are normal as like singular and selfish.
But that doesn't answer her problem, which is that she has to do twice the amount of work.
And I mean,
I know, but like, it's like uncontrovertible that the people who suffer from the way the workplace is set up are women with children. Like, it's women with children who don't get promoted and who get demoted and who don't move ahead and whose bosses don't see them as committed workers. So, yeah, like,
that's,
she's got to do some extra work. But like, it's the women with children who everyone thinks of as divided and unable to be decent workers, you know? But I think, like, if the boss, I don't know.
One thing that really strikes me is that our countries maternity and paternity leave policies are the worst and the stingiest in the developed world. And we still can't even kind of make them not be horrible, either for the person who's taking care of their child and being worried that now their career has been irreparably damaged, and the people who are covering for them, who are working hard and worried that they're not getting appropriately compensated for the work that they're doing. It's like, is anybody getting a fair deal other than the employers who are choosing not to employ enough people but demanding that more work be done?
Right. So I see what you're saying. So instead of having like one person have to pick up a slack for this other person and then that person feel resentful, like if the whole system kind of understood that this is a natural part of the cycle and that we're going to have a few workers off, X number of workers off on maternity leave, like would there be an easier way to shift the burden so that one person doesn't end up staying, you know, many, many hours and feeling resentful? All right. And here's our final caller.
My issue is this. I'm uncomfortable with referring to myself as a feminist. I'm a white heterosexual male who is trying to stay awake to the privilege and entitlement that this confers on me every day. Many times when I express this discomfort, my female friends and colleagues take issue with it. The part of what they say that makes a lot of sense to me is that they've told me that by my claiming the descriptor, I would show solidarity with them. But it still feels to me like I'm trying to dodge something, like I'm trying to say, hey, I'm one of the good ones. But I think it's actually more important for white hetero men like myself to take responsibility for the bigotry in our culture by owning up to our witting and unwitting participation in it. Calling myself a feminist feels like a dodge. Is my prioritizing my discomfort over the potential benefits to society of my expressing solidarity yet another way in which I'm making it about me? I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. Thank you.
Well, my number one piece of advice for male feminists is never call yourself a male feminist. It instantly makes me suspect you of being very much otherwise in your deepest soul of souls and trying to overcompensate. Now, that might be extremely unfair of me, but that is my quick knee-jerk reaction. And I just have to share that with you male feminists out there listening so that, you know, assholes like me don't judge you.
And I have a kind of a similar response, which is that when you get so hung up on labels, which, hey, and I'm a person who's pretty hung up on labels, so I'll take that. It just makes me think that when, like, it's like going to the paint store and, you know, on the can of paint, it says green paint and green paint is everywhere. But then you open it up and it's red paint. Does that mean it's still green paint? Like, just prove that you are a feminist. Don't be talking about, hey, I'm a feminist. Just do things that are feminist things that are not, you know, relying on your white hetero male privilege.
You know, I've been reading on vacation the Karl Ove Knausgård My Struggle book too.
Nicely pronounced, like, by the way.
I can't even compete with you a little bit, June, on this show. You know, I feel like it's given me a window that, you know, here you've got this like hetero macho dude in Sweden where there are certain male feminist requirements, and yet you are witnessing his stream of consciousness. And it feels more true to me than this kind of rigid, you know, am I this label or have I done this thing? Like, he's constantly, I guess that he would never say this, you know, he would very much object to saying that he's, you know, checking his white male privilege. But he does have this weird self-consciousness about, you know, I just saw that woman behind the coffee counter and she's really hot and I really love these high black boots and I wish that these high black boots would stay in season for the next 25 years. Oh, my God, I'm doing it again. You know, why am I doing this again? Linda's waiting at home with my children and I can't wait to go see her. And, you know, but I feel like you're getting something more true, which is that we are in a moment where people are figuring this out and you should be a little more honest with whatever it is you're feeling at that moment and not shut down everything because it is feminist or it isn't feminist or your friends might call it feminist. Like, you will have feelings and they will sometimes comport to, you know, the label, and they sometimes won't comport to the label, and you can just think about whether they're okay or not okay. It feels a little robotic to me to be like, I am this or I'm not this. No?
Yeah. And for people who are wondering if we're really answering this guy's question, I suspect we're not totally answering this guy's question because we are a little bit rejecting this guy's question because it sounds a little
disingenuous?
Yeah, it sounds a little.
But don't you think guys, like, don't you guys know guys in Brooklyn, aren't they really wondering about this kind of stuff? Like, am to call myself a male feminist?
Absolutely. No, and that's the question that we're answering because, yeah, no, I absolutely know for sure that men are very unsure how they should show their solidarity, especially in very, you know, at all kinds of situations and in every interaction that they have. So I absolutely recognize the uncertainty. But I just think getting too hung up on what you call yourself and, you know, how you display your awareness of your own privilege is just an expression of privilege.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea that, okay, so we take it as a given that the most right-thinking people are feminists, but there could be value in an environment where that's not the assumption in declaring yourself and aligning yourself with that as someone who's unexpected, you know, as a man. What we're all reacting to is people who are climbing all over themselves to, it's almost like they want like carbon offsets or yeah. They just want, okay, like, I just don't group me in with those guys. I don't know. I just have this visceral reaction, you know, that people think by saying that they're not part of something, they're not part of something. But like June said, just sort of act in a way that you know to be good and right. And I think that will set you on the feminist path, whether right. male or female.
Right.
I mean, I feel like the rest of the show gave you some tips. Don't call a little girl a little princess. Don't complain about the voices of the women who work with you at work. You probably know all these. They're obvious. But there are ways you can spread that word. Well, that was fun. Thank you, listeners, for calling in. We deeply appreciate your calls. Don't take personally any of our answers. We just kind of get rolling with our own momentum sometimes. But we love you all for listening, and we deeply appreciate your calling in. And if you're in my neighborhood, please do come to the live show on September 21st at Woolly Mammoth. All right, let's move on to our recommendations. Before we do, we want to thank our third sponsor, Next Issue, which is premium content that you don't have to waste time finding. I have had this app now for a few weeks, and I love it. It is basically a compilation of all of my favorite magazines, highbrow, middlebrow, lowbrow, on nearly every subject. It's a mobile app that lets you tap directly into the most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using a phone or tablet. I feel like I've been waiting for this app for a long, long time. People Magazine, The New Yorker, Vogue, Esquire, all these magazines that I kind of let go because I don't want my house to be stacked up with magazines, I can now read them right on my phone. Sign up for Next Issue right now. You get immediate access to all of the top magazines, including back issues and exclusive videos and photos. So, Next Issue is offering a free trial right now when you go to nextissue.com/XX, spelled out D-O-U-B-L-E-X. Again, nextissue.com/XX, and you can try the Next Issue for free. All right, recommendations. June, how about you?
I want to recommend a movie that opens on Friday, August 21st, Grandma, with Lily Tomlin, directed and written by Paul White. Amazingly, I can't believe this movie is by a man. Like many people, I love Lily Tomlin. I think of her as a fantastic performer, a kind of a supporting actress, though, in movies and TV. She is so amazing in this fantastic movie, which is about, in some ways, it's about an abortion. It's about, you know, this woman's granddaughter comes to her and needs to raise money for an abortion that she has an appointment for later that day. And so they go out on the road trying to raise the money. But it's also about a lesbian widow. She's lost her partner 18 months earlier. And it's just such a beautiful movie. I know what I've just said sounds very harsh and acerbic, but it's a really gentle, loving, very sort of indie observational movie. And I don't know that I would have gone to see it. I saw it because I was going to review it for Slate because Dana's on vacation. And it blew me away. It really is fantastic.
That sounds great. The previews look surprisingly good, like really tender and interesting.
Exactly. And that's the kind of movie it is. It's the kind of movie that doesn't really exist much anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Good. Something to see. I'm going to recommend something that's both completely common and totally obscure. But these are the two things that have given me the most pleasure on my vacation over the last week. The first is the This American Life episode, The Problem We All Live With. It's by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's an investigative reporter at The New York Times. It is so good. It's like a school that tried to desegregate, but it happened a couple of years ago. And she has this amazing audio from these school meetings, which just make you want to die. Like, you can't believe this is audio from 2013. And yet it is. And it's so interesting to try and piece together these issues. But it was really, really fabulous. You think like, oh, I've heard this story a million times. But trust me, you have not heard this story a million times. It's really, really good. Okay, now this is going to be the most obscure recommendation ever, but it's given me so much pleasure. It is called the Henry VIII Disappearing Wives mug.
You're recommending a mug?
Okay, I got to tell you how cool this is. So you, okay, you can make fun of me for the rest of my life. But what happens is there's a picture of Henry VIII and all of his wives. And then when you pour in the water, each of the wives shows up. Then the way that he killed them shows up under them, like beheaded.
Divorce, beheaded, dies, divorce, beheaded, survives.
And then it fades away, like each of the women fades away as you are drinking your tea. I will never drink anything from a different cup again. It is so awesome.
That's really funny.
It's really awesome. And it's made by the Unemployed Philosophers Guild. And I'm sure you can buy it on Amazon. And it's just so awesome. My in-laws happen to have it. And I just like I sleep with it every night. All right. Noreen.
My recommendation is it's either out or just about to be out, Carly Rae Jepsen album called Emotion. Now, you probably know her from Call Me Maybe. Think she's a one-hit wonder. Then she played Cinderella on Broadway. That's the last we heard from her. This album's really fun. It's just a great pop album that you're going to dance along to. If you run, you're going to want to run along to it. I've been doing work to it, all kinds of things. It's just download it, go to Spotify, buy it, and let yourself enjoy this late summer, early fall with Carly Rae.
I want to cue in Stephen Metcalf here.
Listen.
Just to take you down.
It's
just to make you defensive. And
did
like,
you
know.
Like Call Me Maybe, Hannah? Did you sing along to that?
You know, I'm a total, I listen to pop music a lot, really, mm-hmm. like an embarrassing amount. And I really liked Call Me Maybe. I'm not like crazy about this album, but I haven't listened to the whole album. So I'm going to take your advice. And on my long drive home from Vermont to Washington, D.C., I'm going to force everyone to listen to it. So I'm down with it. It's okay.
It's like a good pop album. It doesn't, you know, the lyrics don't wash over you with great meaning and change your life. But if you want to feel a little happy about life, put it on.
That was mean. Like, if you want to not be the kind of, like, crabby person that you are.
Yeah, you're overreading. Right, beheaded.
I will. Beheaded. All right. Thanks to our producer, Ann Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our intern, Jesse Chasen Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the ever-growing Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. Show page is slate.com/XX if you want to find out more about this show. The Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGapFest to leave comments and suggestions about what we should talk about next. Email is XXGapFest@slate.com. And as always, subscribe on iTunes so more people can find out about the show. Thank you so much for joining us. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Hello, who's that speaking, please?